seated. Welcome, everyone. It's nice to have live with everyone alive, so good to have you all here. Just a reminder about your time limits. I'm sure you're very familiar with that. Also, if you are referencing the record, please give us a record cite. Please recall that rebuttal is for rebuttal only. And with that, I think we have very well experienced lawyers here, so we'll just get to it. I am not going to read all 11 cases because that would take your whole 40 minutes. So I will just say case number 19-10649, United States versus Castillo and the other consolidated cases. And we will begin with Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Although the appellants present a variety of challenges in this consolidated appeal, this court can resolve each case using the following two-step analysis. First, Your Honors, you should accept the orders on limited remand as an explicit indication of the district court's intent. In those orders, the district court explained that it had not imposed the challenge conditions in an attempt to carry out or clarify any of the other conditions included in the judgment. It instead indicated a previously unstated policy preference for a list of standard conditions no longer in effect.
I noticed that you didn't distinguish Holland in your reply brief. The government cited it. What? How do you distinguish Holland that basically, that was about the people and place kind of being the same thing?
Yes, Your Honor. Now Holland is an unpublished decision, and I decided not to deal with it largely based on space issues. I think it's wrongly decided. I think it's wrongly decided,
wrongly
Your Honor,
decided.
And I think it's unpersuasive. That's true for a couple different reasons. On the one hand, whereas the Sentencing Commission did in fact excise the shall not frequent condition because its concerns were encompassed within another condition, the one that prohibits defendants from interacting with those knowingly engaged in criminal activity, that does not mean that the conditions are literally redundant. I think what it means is that the commission's primary concern with the shall not frequent condition was subsumed within the other, so the shall not frequent condition was superfluous. But that doesn't mean that by violating one, you necessarily violate the other, and I think we can prove that with a series of hypotheticals. So for instance,
Counsel, before you go there, let me ask you this. Do we go with what the Sentencing Commission stated, that it was a duplicative condition, so therefore it was unnecessary? Or are we to go with the plain language of the condition? I mean, where I suspect you're going with the hypotheticals. I mean, in other words, how much credence do we give, not only Holland, but also what the Sentencing Commission said, that this condition was redundant?
Well, Your Honor, I think we do need to look at the explicit language of the conditions. We need to compare the out-of-date, shall-not-frequent condition included in the judgment with the up-to-date condition, which prohibits interaction with criminals.
How much force do we give what the Sentencing Commission said as far as its rationale for deleting the condition?
Well, I think the rationale, Your Honor, is ultimately irrelevant in light of the textual differences between the two conditions. And to the extent we're to defer to it at all, I would just point out those textual differences and note that they are not literally redundant. It's just that the concerns the Sentencing Commission had about one could be subsumed within the other.
So Holland, you say, is not persuasive. What's your best case to lead us to where you want us to go?
Your Honor, I think the best case on the shall not frequent condition is, I believe it would be Tang, Your Honor. In Tang, this court dealt with an oral pronouncement which prohibited a defendant from cohabitating with anyone with children under the age of 18. In the condition, in the judgment, the judge added a no dating rule. It was subsumed within the same condition. All they added was two words, cohabitate or date. So we know that that judge, we can infer from the facts of that case, that the judge's concerns were the defendant gaining access to young people, because the defendant had repeatedly violated sexual registration laws, had used false names, and had moved in with women who he was dating, who had minor children. So the district court's concerns were clearly, the district court's intent was clearly in line with that no dating prohibition, but there was still a conflict, because we looked at the objective meaning of what the district court said to the defendants in court, and that objective meaning was different from the additional restriction added in the judgment. And I actually go back at this point to focus on what the district court said in each of these defendants' presence, because that's where we must begin our analysis in any of these conflict cases. In each case, the district court indicated that it would impose the standard conditions of supervised release that would be set forth in a forthcoming judgment. So, given the timing and the content of those statements, I think a reasonable listener could only interpret them to refer to the conditions recommended as standard in the 2018 edition.
I'm wondering if the distinction from everything else is this judge's clarification. I mean, do we have to decide everything for every district court, or do we look at what happened in these cases, which were this judge's clarification? Does that make any difference? Is that different from Holland, which involved a different district judge who did not give a clarification?
Your Honor, I do think it's different, and I think it actually helps our argument, not the government's. If the district court had intended the shout-out frequent condition to carry out or clarify these mandatory conditions cited by the government or the standard condition that prohibits defendants from interacting with criminals, it would have said so. And had it said so, my job today would be much harder. It did not. It explained that it kept and retained each of the conditions in its standard list of conditions based on policy preferences. I think we can infer from that fact the district court believed that each individual condition was therefore necessary to address its sentencing concerns. Now, the district court is free to do that. It just has to tell us that it's doing it. It has to tell the defendants that it's doing it before it does so.
And now the judge is, I mean, has made clear that
he's
carefully doing that.
He is, Your Honor, but not in the presence of the defendants, and that's the problem. So he is after the fact, injected some ambiguity or attempted to inject ambiguity.
No, I mean, like if you were getting sentencing today, if someone was getting sentenced today, I mean, he already made that clear that he's now providing sort of the list of his conditions, and that's fine.
Right? Yes, Your Honor, that's fine.
Okay, so this only really deals with the past, this case.
That's correct,
Your Honor. Which is important. I'm not detracting from that, but I'm just saying we're not dealing with the situation where a judge is insisting that saying the standard is good enough going forward.
No, Your Honor, and again, I think that helps my case. I mean, Judge McBride changed his procedures because he realized that the procedures he had been using were insufficient to warn the defendants of his idiosyncratic approach to the sentencing condition, or to the standard conditions of supervised release. And on that note, Your Honor, before we leave the order on limited remand, you know, Judge McBride chided the parties for assuming that his reference to the standard conditions referred to the guidelines manual at all. He referred to them repeatedly as his own conditions of supervised release. Now, that is a difficult, that claim is difficult to jibe with the source of these conditions. Because in fact, Judge McBride's conditions are drawn from an earlier version of the guidelines manual. It appears that, although there are slight changes in language, it appears that Judge McBride was using the standard conditions recommended by the Sentencing Commission between 1987 and October 31st, 1997. So they were not conditions of his own creation. They were simply out-of-date standard conditions.
Well, but counsel, I mean, he'd be free to do that as long as he pronounced them at the sentencing hearing, such that they were discussed by counsel. What Diggles requires.
Right? Absolutely, Your Honor.
Well, so let me ask a specific question. I think about two of the four conditions that are at issue here. If I've got it right, two of them relate only to Ms. Goosby. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I think that I've got this right. I'm hoping you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but in Goosby's case, all the conditions, or both the conditions that are at issue, were part of her previous sentence, correct? In other words, pre-2016, pre-amendment to the guidelines. In other words, she had the conditions in front of her when she was initially sentenced. So when the court referenced them when she was there for a revocation hearing, she already had notice of those conditions, did she not?
Your Honor, I do not think so, and I would point to the court's specific words in front of her. So, well, she had...
Well, I know there's ambiguity in what the district court said, but her counsel actually objected to a couple of the previously existing conditions, and they modified them, correct?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't that strongly suggest that if they had an objection to either of the two that are challenged today, they could have raised them then as well?
Your Honor, it does. But, and actually on this point, Your Honor, I'd like to admit to a mistake in my reply brief. In the reply brief, I note on page 13... That discussion of the two conditions that could be altered did not deal with the standard conditions. I was wrong about that. That was a misreading of the record on my part. But I nevertheless believe that the abuse of discretion standard applies, and here's why. So the district court did, in fact, engage in a colloquy with counsel about taking out a few words in one of the standard conditions. However, he did not commit to reimposing those conditions. What he said at the end of that colloquy was, if we reimpose those conditions, I will include that change. Then about 15 pages later in the record, when actually orally pronouncing the sentence, the district court said, I will impose these standard conditions of supervised release that will be set forward in a judgment that will be forthcoming. So during the actual oral pronouncement, the judge again looked forward to a judgment that would be coming out in the future.
But isn't that what he said originally at the original Goosby sentencing?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I did not review the record for the original.
Okay, so, I mean, because the context there is experience with this defendant in this judge's court as opposed to just somebody walks in and doesn't know what they mean by X or Y.
So 2 points on that.
Why isn't that different?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. First, at her initial sentencing hearing in 2013, had the district court said, I'm going to impose these standard conditions, he would not have subverted her expectations by including the conditions that were in the judgment, because at that point, they were up to date. She was sentenced in 2013, so the pre-2016 conditions would not surprise anyone. The problem, though, Your Honor, is this. After that 2016 amendment, the judge, under the guidelines, should have been applying the guidelines manual in its entirety. Ms. Goosby was revoked on June 20th, 2019, and although there is some reference to those conditions, when orally pronouncing the sentence, Judge McBride moved away from that and again referred simply to the standard conditions.
Did any of her conditions change from the original sentence to the revocation?
I don't think so, Your Honor, no.
One quick question, housekeeping while I've got it. Mr. Guevara Bonilla, according to the notes I've got, he was released from, incarceration July 2nd, 2020, and there was a one-year term of supervised release. Is his claim now moot?
Yes, Your Honor, it is, and I was planning to get to that before.
Okay.
But, Your Honor, let's return to the merits of the case. I'd like to go back through a few hypotheticals.
Well, one more question on the merits, I guess. The final condition, as directed by the probation officer condition, how is the old version and the new version, how are they different?
Well, here's why, Your Honor. The old version applies at the probation officer's unfettered discretion. Now, of course, as the government pointed out in its response, the probation officer is not going to order Mr. Zamudio to act unless the probation officer has some concern about risk, but the risk required by the old condition is a low quantum of risk. It's risk that may be occasioned. The new condition only applies if the probation officer determines that Mr. Zamudio, in fact, poses a risk to an identified individual. So, and I think there's a couple differences there.
But aren't both of these conditions really contingent on the discretion of the probation officer such that there's no real difference?
No, Your Honor, they are. The probation officer in either case is the individual making an assessment of risk and ordering Mr. Zamudio to act. But again, I think the analyses are different. And because the analyses are different, and because the up-to-date condition is narrower than the out-of-date condition, there is, in fact, a conflict. And again, I think it's helpful to work in hypotheticals here because it helps make concrete some of the claims I'm making. So with regard to Mr. Zamudio, the out-of-date condition would allow the probation officer to order him, on the basis of a 2016 family violence assault, to warn any women he meets about the risk of violence or perhaps any women he dates. Now, under the up-to-date condition, that's not true. The probation officer would have to identify the at-risk party and then make a one-to-one assessment regarding whether or not, based on his record, his current status in life, and his relationship with that party, if there is, in fact, a risk that requires notification. I think you can make a similar point concerning the PSR establishes that Mr. Zamudio also has been a pretty heavy drug user for most of his life. It talks about methamphetamine use from ages 16 to 26, almost daily. It talks about marijuana use between the ages of 13 and 26. I think under the old condition, a probation officer could require Mr. Zamudio to inform employers, to warn potential employers about his past drug use and its effects on his performance at work. Under the new condition, that's not true. Under the new condition, the probation officer would be required to identify the party, identify the risk, and make sure that that's a risk that he actually opposes as opposed to a risk that may be occasioned by his criminal record or drug use. And on that note, Your Honor, I'd like to pivot quickly to the shall not frequent condition, the hypothetical there, since that is a condition that 9 of the appellants raise. So Mr. Hoyos lives in Fort Worth. He was born there, he's raised there, he's lived there up to this case. If he were to be released from prison and go to work at a grocery store, and that grocery store had a parking lot where drug dealers congregated and met with their buyers, and I know there are grocery stores like that in Fort Worth through my practice as a trial lawyer there. If he were to arrive at the grocery store every morning for work, walk through the parking lot to his station, he would be frequenting a location where drugs are legally sold, but he would not thereby have violated the other conditions cited by the government, because he would be in violation regardless of whether he used drugs or possessed drugs. He would also be in violation regardless of whether he interacted with any drug dealers while there. Your Honor, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll hear from the government first, from Ms. Falconer.
May it please the court? Emily Falconer for the United States, and I'm here with my colleague, Mr. Stephen Gilstrap. I'm going to discuss the shall not frequent condition, as well as the notified third parties, and my colleague is going to discuss the 5-day reporting condition and the drug paraphernalia condition, which are the two raised by Ms. Goosby. To begin, this case has a complex procedural history, but ultimately the inquiry is simple. I mean, the two questions are, what did the defendants understand? What conditions did the defendants understand based on the sentencing hearing?
How do you address this Walmart hypo where somebody is simply taking a job working at Walmart, or we'll just say a grocery store, we won't use a name, the grocery store, and it turns out, though, that there are people who meet in the parking lot and do drug deals. Not the fault of the grocery store, but it just happens. And he has to walk by that because the employees have to park far away from the front door. That's all he's doing. Is that, that's a violation of the Judge McBride standard, but it's not a violation of the standard standard. How do you address that?
We disagree with that for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. The first one is that the condition, the argument there, that hypothetical about drug dealers at the grocery store, is inconsistent with even the defendant's own briefing, in which they referred to it as a, quote, trap house condition, which means that their natural reading of the condition is that it prohibits them from going to places where the specific purpose of the place is to buy and sell illegal drugs. And I think that's the most natural reading of the condition. The Sentencing Commission also thought that that was what the condition meant. And I think they are to...
And so what is that? I mean, because there's seldom a building that says, this is the drug house, please come. So typically drug dealing is done sometimes in a plain old house, but in places where something else going on, a park, whatever, or somebody's home, that is their home, but then they also do drug dealing. So I guess I'm trying to understand how it, you know, because it's very critical. If you're on supervised release, you better comply with it. So they need to know, it needs to be clear. So you're saying it's clear they can go to this grocery store that's full of drug dealers in the parking lot, but they can't go where? Where can't they go?
So they cannot, and I think the hard work, to answer your question, Judge Haynes, the hard work that's being done in that condition is the word frequent. The defendants, upon their release, are prohibited from frequenting places where drugs, illegal drugs, are...
What if they like to walk in the park every day? Or what if the hypo was working at that grocery store? So, of course, they're all, every day, they park in the, as far away from the door as possible, so the customers get the better parking, walk down that long parking lot where there's all these drug dealers, but they don't interact with them. Now, that would be not a violation under the current standard. So tell me why it's not a violation of the standard here.
Our position with respect to that hypothetical, I have two answers to that. To respond to the specific hypothetical, our position is that the grocery store, the HEB or the Albertsons itself, is not a place where drugs are bought and sold. I mean, you're in the bread aisle and there's people selling drugs in the parking lot. You know, you're there to buy your milk and your newspaper. That you're not in the place where they're selling drugs.
The counsel, an employee who's assigned to go get the carts from the parking lot on a regular basis would be frequently in the parking lot where, in Judge Haynes' hypothetical, drug deals are going on. In other words, it's not the shopper that's going there to get bread and eggs. It's the person who works there who's going to be in that position 5-6 days a week. How's that not frequenting a place where drugs are sold?
I think that we could come up with scenarios like that. I mean, I think for any number of different sort of wording variances between different conditions. I think ultimately we have to go back to what the commission thought that the condition.
All right, well, let's stop right there because I think that was where I was going to go. We can come up with hypotheticals. Another one is, for example, what if a fella lives in an apartment complex that's drug-ridden? It may not be his apartment, but all the common areas. I mean, we could go on and on about hypotheticals. So what are we to do as the court? And I ask counsel opposite this as well. How much emphasis do we put on what the Sentencing Commission thought or what they said as far as why they were repealing this condition or deleting it versus the fact that textually we had a condition before, we don't have one now, and the text of the prior condition is different than the currently existing condition, the one they said was duplicative, right? So is it enough for us to say, well, we can come up with hypotheticals, therefore this thing is overbroad or it's not the same or there's a conflict? Or tell me, how do we do it the way you want us to do it?
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of that question. So,
tell me how we get there using the text of the guidelines, knowing that one has been deleted, but the text is distinct between the one that the commission says is redundant.
I'm a little technical difficulty here. I think that the issue before the court here, where you have one that's been deleted, is exactly what the court did in Holland, exactly what this court did in Garcia. I mean, the court's analysis does not, about some variance in the language of conditions, survive Diggles. Diggles is aimed to clarify the law with respect to what has to be pronounced at sentencing. And at the end of the day, the purpose was for the law to be more clear. Now, the road that these types of hypotheticals
Yes, but if the law is to be more clear, I am now confused about what this standard of this supervised release condition is about the places where drugs are sold. And if I'm confused, and I've been a lawyer for decades and a judge for decades, that's a little bit worrisome, isn't it, for criminal defendants who presumably have not been lawyers and judges for decades?
I think we have a good reason not to be worried about it, which is that it was in the guidelines for years before the Diggles was decided and before the 2016 amendments in Section 803, and we did not see appeals where people were getting their probation revoked for working at a grocery store where people sold drugs in the parking lot. I mean, ultimately, this is not a categorical analysis. In fact, the court is quite the opposite of a categorical analysis of comparing the precise language of what was pronounced with a wording difference. And it's also the law that if the district court, there's no conflict when a judgment condition simply effectuates what was in what was pronounced at sentencing. So at sentencing, it was pronounced, I mean, he understands it mandatorily.
Ms. Falcon, how do you address the facts of this case? So even if we accepted what you said as sort of a generic issue, this judge's clarification sounds a bit different from the sort of generic world that you were addressing. How do we address this case? These cases.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Our view is that the district judge's clarification order is not relevant to the legal analysis here. Ultimately, the pronouncement analysis is a due process inquiry that notice and the notice that they received at the sentencing hearing is the relevant question. They agree that they received notice at the hearing that they would be imposed to what they understood the court to mean was that it would be the current set of standard conditions. Now, later...
But counsel, isn't that the crux of the problem, is that the defendant under Diggles is supposed to be able to know what the conditions the court is proposing, be able to talk about that with counsel, have the opportunity to object. So by definition, if the defendant doesn't know what the condition, which condition the court intends to oppose, how can Diggles be satisfied?
Absolutely. We agree going forward that...
We're not talking about going forward. We're talking about these cases and the rights of these defendants.
These are pre-Diggles cases. So we have a situation where something was pronounced. They understood it to mean the current conditions. We agree that the outdated conditions were not pronounced, but yet the court's inquiry still stands as to whether there is a difference. Now, as Judge Haynes mentioned, the district court is free going forward to impose anything it wants under the sun so long as it pronounces it under Diggles. But here, we have to look at what was the law at the time of the hearing, what did they understand it to mean, with respect to the district court's analysis that its own conditions were somehow extremely different and unique. That's just not played out by comparing the text of them side by side. So I'm going to go ahead and turn the floor over to my colleague to discuss the other things, and he can also answer any more questions about this condition as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Belcher. So, Mr. Gilstrap, I guess you can address, I know that y'all addressed different pieces, but this is sort of a policy question that I have for you. Why are we here? I mean, you all took it back to say this was a clerical error, you know, fix it, judge, and then the judge disagreed. Why didn't y'all say, well, we'll just agree with the defendants on this one?
Of course, Judge Haynes. Stephen Gilstrap, and may it please the court. To answer that question, when the government agreed to the limited remand earlier, that was to determine whether there was, in fact, a clerical error or to obtain clarification, as the district court said here, that there wasn't a clerical error. And once the district court confirmed that, in its view, it did not make a clerical error, we looked at the conditions, we looked at Holland, we looked at what the Sentencing Commission said about them, and based on our analysis, we did not see a conflict between the conditions that were imposed, the oral pronouncement, and the written judgment. And because we didn't see a conflict as to the four conditions, especially the two that are relevant to Ms. Goosby, where we have the pronouncement issue that Judge Wilson was talking about earlier, we didn't see a conflict, and under this court's case law, because we didn't see a conflict, there wasn't a basis to concede error. And kind of going forward with that, even if the district court said that it had a preference for these outdated conditions, that's not dispositive to the question of whether there's a conflict or not, for a couple reasons. First is, these conditions have multiple pieces and multiple parts. The defendants are not challenging every piece or every part of the conditions. And the standard condition 10 in Ms. Goosby's case that relates to drug paraphernalia is a great example of this, because that condition has the excessive alcohol restriction that was involved in the colloquy between Ms. Goosby's counsel and the district court at her revocation hearing. It has restrictions on drug possession and use and drug paraphernalia use and possession. When the Sentencing Commission amended the standard conditions in 2016 as part of Amendment 803, it dealt with those two pieces differently. It said, we think that the excessive alcohol condition fits best in a special condition and should only apply in certain circumstances. But as to the controlled substances piece of that outdated standard condition, we believe that that's covered by other mandatory conditions where you can't violate a federal, state, or local law, you can't use or possess drugs, et cetera. And so just because you prefer an outdated standard condition, or even if you think the outdated standard condition is different, that may be true as to part of it, but you have to look at what specifically is being challenged here.
But what doesn't standard drug use involve paraphernalia?
It does, Your Honor. And so that's one of our reasons that we think that there is redundancy between drug paraphernalia, possession and use, and the use of drugs, which everyone admits and concedes is covered by mandatory conditions. Also, in Texas, it is against state law to possess drug paraphernalia. So if you possess drug paraphernalia, you would be in violation of state law, which is another mandatory condition. And so that's why we believe that that condition, which is relevant only to Ms. Goosby, even if you think that abuse of discretion applies as opposed to plain error, as the government argues, there's no conflict between the two because the substance of that is covered. Moving backwards, I guess, to the reporting condition, the analysis is really the same. Under the current version of the probation reporting condition, a district court or a probation officer can choose the how and when a defendant reports to probation. There's no dispute about that. Here, all that happened is in the district court's revocation judgment, it gave Defendant Goosby the how and the when. It said, you're going to report to probation and you're going to submit a written report within the first 5 days of the month. While the current conditions envision that that sort of additional specific guidance will be given once they're on supervised release and have reported initially, essentially the only difference is the district court gave Ms. Goosby additional notice than the current standard conditions envision. It didn't enlarge anything. It didn't broaden the condition. It just gave her notice of how she was going to have to report.
Let me ask you something going back to the initial interchange that we had, which is, you know, I asked you kind of like, why are we here? And you said, well, because we gave the judge a chance to assess whether there's a clerical error, and he said there wasn't. So it seems to me like, why was it remanded if you didn't think there was a clerical error? And then since the judge didn't think there was and gave this clarification, why is that clarification irrelevant, as your colleague said?
We thought that there was a possibility that there was a clerical error based on, as Mr. Brown has talked about, the language of I'm imposing these standard conditions. We thought that there was at least an ambiguity there. And it turns out Judge McBride was not the only district judge that had been imposing certain outdated conditions. Other district judges in the Fort Worth Division mainly.
And they all said it was a clerical error.
They said it was a clerical error.
Here. So then I'm wondering, again, why is a judge's clear, the judge who's going to enforce the supervised release, if somebody is brought back and said, oh, this person violated the supervised release, it's going to come back to that judge. Why is his clarification irrelevant?
Well, I think it's irrelevant as to the Diggles pronouncement issue. I think that is what Ms. Falconer was saying when she said it was irrelevant. Because when you pronounce the sentence, what you say after the fact as to what you meant or everything or anything like that, that really is irrelevant as to the Diggles analysis. As to whether there's a conflict or not, which is really the second step in the analysis if this court is to find a pronouncement error, which the government concedes as to everyone but Ms. Goosby for the reasons that Judge Wilson and Mr. Brown talked about. Whether there's a conflict or not is an issue for this court to decide, as it did in Holland. Whether Judge McBride believes that...
But Holland wasn't faced with... It was a different judge, and there wasn't a clarification, so Holland wasn't faced with the facts we have here. So, I mean, I realize it's unpublished, we're not bound, but we respect unpublished opinions. But even if we respect it and say it's fine as it is, does that mean that we have to come out the same way, given that I see a distinction here? Because y'all went back and asked the judge, and the judge was very clear that he's leaving this stuff in, obviously because he doesn't think they all just glob together. Why would he? I mean, if it all is the same thing, why leave it in there? And because he knew there was going to be an appeal, and he knew all of what was going to transpire. So if he thought A and B are the same thing, could have said, well, I meant to impose both A and B, but they're the same thing. He obviously didn't think so. Why is that irrelevant?
Well, and I think when you look at the limited remand order, and there are several iterations because these kind of went back in different packs, there is not a specific statement of Judge McBride saying, I think the shall not frequent condition is substantively different than the do not associate with known criminals condition. It's not at that level of granularity. It is more, of the mindset of these are the standard conditions that I impose because I prefer these standard conditions. But there's not, and I prefer them for some policy basis. He doesn't really get into the details of, I think these are broader, or I think these are narrower, or anything like that. He just says he prefers them. And it's not a sort of condition by condition analysis as to the four conditions that are at issue here. I mean, he doesn't dig into the notify third parties condition and say, oh, I think this one is different than the current version for this reason. It's just kind of more of a generalized statement of, these are my preferred conditions. But that doesn't mean that these preferred conditions are broader or more onerous so as to create a conflict under this court's precedent.
Didn't he just pretty much say, this is the way I've always done it?
He did, Your Honor. He said, these are the conditions that I've been entering for 20 plus years, and people who practice in my court regularly know that these are the conditions, and that was basically his analysis. Yes, Your Honor. With the last minute of my time, I'll briefly discuss remedy, because I think, you know, it's important. For the reasons stated in the government's brief and presented an argument today, the government believes that there is not a sufficient conflict between the oral pronouncement and the written judgment in any of the cases, so we believe this court can affirm the judgments as they are. That said, to the extent that this court finds that there is a conflict as to, you know, any of the conditions or one of the conditions or something like that, the government and the appellants agree with this, believe that the court can and should, under 28 U.S.C. 2106, just affirm the judgments as modified to take account for any conditions that need to be struck. Given the limited remand that already occurred here, the fact
that— So you're saying we don't send it back to the district judge?
I think it—
This word needs to be deleted. We just deleted, is what you're saying.
This court can do that under the precedent cited in our brief, and I think given the previous remands and the fact that there are 11 cases just for a judicial economy—
We don't need to add to the district court's work.
That would be the government's recommendation, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, and we will hear your rebuttal, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to address three topics briefly that came up in the government's argument. I'd like to address the district court's order, I'd like to address the structure of the judgment, and I'd like to address Mr. Gilstrap's arguments with regard to Ms. Goosby. I'll begin with the order. So I agree that the order is not dispositive on this court's analysis, but these conflict cases often turn on the district court's intent, and the order is the best indication we have of the district court's intent with regard to the various conditions and their relationship to one another. Now, the government is arguing that the conditions I have challenged are generally consistent with the district court's intent, but consistency is not enough. The terms of one condition must be literally subsumed within another, such that they are actually redundant, and you can't violate one without violating the other. I'd also note that the government, in their briefing at least, attempts to glean intent where the district court exercised none. So they point to mandatory conditions involving prohibiting the use and possession of controlled substances. Now, those are mandatory conditions, so their imposition in any particular case tells us nothing about the district court's sentencing concerns. Next, Your Honor, I'd like to briefly address the structures of the judgment. We focused primarily today on the text and comparing the out-of-date conditions with the up-to-date conditions. But another arrow in my quiver is the fact that the judgments themselves separate these rules into separate prohibitions. So in your typical ambiguity case, the district court will announce generally that a defendant must engage in some sort of treatment or some sort of drug testing. And then in the judgment, there will be some additional rule concerning that you must pay costs incurred, or that, for instance, in a recent case called—
All in the same paragraph is what you're saying?
Exactly right, Your Honor. Exactly right. And that makes the court's intent clear.
That's sort of an extra text argument, that when you have different paragraphs, they ought to be saying different things. We learned that in law school. We don't all follow it.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think that is appropriate here. So putting aside the district court's order, I think we could infer his intent based on the placement of the various conditions within the judgment. Last, Your Honor, I would like to deal with the Goosby arguments. So first, Mr. Gilstrap.
Well, before you do, though, what is your response to the Judge McBride's clarification is irrelevant argument?
So it's certainly not irrelevant, right? In these cases, we have—
What is the relevance of it? Walk me through that.
Your Honor, I think it is the best indication of the district court's intent regarding the interplay of these conditions. So although that is not dispositive,
I think it helps prove my point if even Judge McBride considered these conditions separate prohibitions that deserve to be enforced separately and placed separately in the judgment.
Okay, and then on the text point, can you summarize, like in one or two sentences, one paragraph, what is your answer to the text versus what the commission thinks point? I want to be clear. I'm not sure I got a clear answer to that when you were responding to Judge Wilson.
Your Honor, the text controls. That is my one sentence answer.
Okay.
I think the commission provided some indication of why it believed they were related generally, and decided that one was.
Well, is it possible that what the commission meant was they're focusing on interacting with the people selling rather than walking through the grocery store parking lot every day without talking to anybody? I mean, in other words, the narrowing, if you will, of that condition is focusing on what really matters, which is interacting with people that are selling drugs, rather than you happen to be in the park where they're selling drugs, but you're just walking your dog.
I think that's true, Your Honor, and I think, again, that helps prove our point that by including the additional condition, Judge McBride has broadened the restrictions that would otherwise apply.
Okay, Goosby.
Yes, Your Honor. Quickly on Goosby. And then with regard to Goosby, first, Your Honor, it would be possible for her to violate the paraphernalia condition without violating the law, and that's because federal law does not actually criminalize the possession of paraphernalia. And Texas law only criminalizes the use or possession with intent to use for specified purposes. The condition is broader than that. The condition says that Ms. Goosby cannot possess it if it's related to a controlled substance. And relation just means that
it has... Is there ambiguity in paraphernalia?
I don't think that term paraphernalia is ambiguous, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
And
so then explain to me why you could have the drug paraphernalia but not violate Texas law, can you?
So under Texas law, you'd have to possess it with intent to use for a specific purpose like ingestion or cultivation. I think that Ms. Goosby could possess a paraphernalia that was related to controlled substances without possessing it with that intent. And again,
so why would you possess it for any other reason?
Well, I'll go back to hypothetical, Your Honor. Let's say that Ms. Goosby finds on the street in front of her house either a crack pipe or a used syringe. She may suspect, she may even know that that item has been used recently to ingest drugs. She may pick it up to give it to a police officer or to throw in the trash. I think her possession would relate to the use of a controlled substance generally, but she would not thereby possess it with intent to ingest drugs on her own. And Your Honor, if I may, just briefly on the written report condition, the up-to-date condition allows Judge McBride to give informal reporting requirements after the initial reporting requirement, after the initial in-person meeting. That is a clear conflict since he has now given them beforehand and codified them in the judgment.
Okay.
That's all I have, Your Honors. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate both sides' arguments, and the case is under submission. Y'all are excused.